We're reading from Matthew chapter 11, verse 28, through to verse 21 of chapter 12. And that's on page 977 in the Church Bible. Page 977, Matthew chapter 11, at verse 28. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. At that time, Jesus went through the cornfields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry and began to pick some ears of corn and eat them. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath." He answered, "Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests. Or haven't you read in the law that the priests on Sabbath duty in the temple desecrate the Sabbath and yet are innocent? I tell you that something greater than the temple is here. If you had known what these words mean, 'I desire mercy, not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent, for the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath." Like Margaret Thatcher. Going on from that place, he went into their synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there, looking for a reason to bring charges against Jesus. They asked him, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" He said to them, "If any of you has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will you not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable is a person than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." Then he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." So he stretched it out, and it was completely restored, just as sound as the other. But the Pharisees went out and plotted how they might kill Jesus. Aware of this, Jesus withdrew from that place. A large crowd followed him, and he healed all who were ill. He warned them not to tell others about him. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. "Here is my servant whom I have chosen, the one I love, in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him, and he will proclaim justice to the nations. He will not quarrel or cry out. No one will hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smouldering wick he will not snuff out, till he has brought justice through to victory. In his name the nations will put their hope."
Yeah, well, do keep that open in front of you. Continuing our series in Matthew, we've been a little bit in and out of that with other things happening this term, but do come with me as we consider what the Lord has to say to us in the next part of our series, Jesus Walks Off the Page. Let's take a moment to pray, and then we'll see what it is the Lord has to say to us. Father, thank you that we can approach you with confidence. Thank you that we come trusting that you speak concerning your Son. And it's him we need. It's him we need to hear. That in the busyness and the weariness of life, it is good for us to stop and be here this morning and hear what you have to say to us. So give us ears to hear. Give us hearts to believe what you say. Fix our attention on your Son that we might honour him. Amen. Let me read you words that 28-year-old Rhian wrote on the BBC website about 10 days ago. She said this, "I don't remember the last time I relaxed. Honestly, I don't know how to. Every time I try and read a book or watch TV, I think about what I have to do next, or my to-do list flashes before my eyes. I feel guilty because I know that I could be cleaning my flat, or at the gym, or buying a birthday present from my boyfriend's mum. My brain never stops. I'm constantly on hyper alert about the things I should be doing, but I can't bring myself to do them. I already suffer from anxiety and depression, and this stress has disrupted my sleep and led to mild insomnia. I think I'm one of many in my generation suffering from millennial burnout. I'm not sure it's just the millennials feeling this. She says, it's all about being hyper-healthy, hyper-clued up, hyper-fashionable, and it's exhausting. She goes on to admit that life has always had its pressures and was difficult too in different ways for her parents' generation and their parents' generation, just as life is difficult for those who've, like her, entered into adulthood in the 21st century. In our frantic society, I'm taken by the idea of the quarterly journal called Delayed Gratification that practices a slow journalism. Instead of that kind of mile-wide, inch-deep analysis that fills our rolling 24-hour news on all our devices all the time, what if we slow down and think more deeply? Or consider perhaps the TV series 24 that ran from 2001 to 2014, in which Kiefer Sutherland's agent Jack Bauer pursued terrorists against a ticking clock and a reminder that events occur in real time. The time pressing the story forward all the time. Everything urgent and intense, as Jack frequently bellowed out, we're running out of time. And yet, for all its dark intensity, deep acts of evil in that mythical world of 24 became light. There was no room to take in what was happening. There was little consequence for the things that happened. One writer reflects that in the world of 24, time served as a fictive device, bias towards action and away from moral reflection. Feels like life might be like that too, for all of us. Here and now, we're always plugged in, always up to date, and yet might we be increasingly out of touch and most of all with ourselves? Our lives are breathless. Or as Augustine put it in the 4th century, our hearts are restless. We might observe the 2x3 meter student study bedroom. That box in which work and rest and sleep are all meant to happen, where the edges are all blurred, and it's no wonder that people are restless and exhausted. Or we find ourselves living in the age of Facebook, where we never need to say goodbye and move on from anyone. We stay connected with more and more and more people who we know we can't keep up with, and each of us trying to share everything about our, well, frankly, uneventful lives, and yet trying to curate our story, ever falling short of a fantasy that's painted by some social media influences that we aspire to be like. And to all those observations of our society, we can add with an open Bible that this is a sin-fallen world, and that for very many, exhaustion and inability to rest is a devastating part of life, due to our own or others' chronic illness, due to our ever-increasing frailty in whatever shape and size that comes. So how countercultural are the words in your hand this morning? These words of Jesus that come, I think, with a clarity that we can barely begin to get our minds around. Have a look down at the end of chapter 11 by Numbers 28 and 29. Hear these words that Jesus says, I will give you rest. You will find rest. I know for me and for others that I spoke to after the service just a couple of weeks ago as we looked at those words then, these are among some of Jesus's most precious words to us. They're a tender invitation to come to him. And whatever else we might say this morning, will you know this? That if your body or your mind or your life is broken, there is rest for your soul in Jesus. You need only do as he says here. Turn and trust him. Come to him. And I have no grounds to promise that if you do that, that everything in your life will get fixed up. Though I know that when Jesus returns, he will make all the sad things come untrue. Yet if we're to take Jesus seriously in these words, then we must say that there is some very real rest to be found, to be had, if you and I will go to him, especially in our brokenness. And it seems to me, in my experience of church life, that it's those who do that, those who recognize their need and go to Jesus, who are wonderful teachers to the rest of us. And we should rightly hold you as our teachers in that regard. Jesus offers rest here in these verses by taking on himself the burden of our sin that we carry on ourselves and offering to us his burden, his light yoke, as he describes it in these verses. And we said last time we looked at these verses that the idea of being offered anything might seem unbearable when everything else is already too much, but that perhaps this is a little like the experience of the marshal I see when I'm running a marathon, offering me things, and I think my legs are too weary to carry anything, and yet the gift of fruit and water that is offered is not intended to finally break my weary legs, but to renew them. Might that be what we find here with Jesus? I'm 4 weeks out from my next marathon, pressing on with a standard schedule of training for that. It's got 4 components, in case you wanted to take up the same occupation. 3 of them are days of running, which build fitness and strength and endurance. They're hard. The 4th component, though, is the rest day. The rest day, in which the body, torn up by all the training, gets to repair and recover. It's really hard to take those days. Get out and do a few more miles. And yet, built into who we are, seems to be a need to stop and to rest. And yet resting's hard, isn't it, in this relentless age that we live in, where the shops never shut, where Amazon will deliver 24/7, where seasonal food is a distant memory because everything's available all the time, where, positively speaking, life expectancy rises. And yet it seems we've never been so weary, so mentally broken particularly. Might this restlessness that we're living in be making us less human somehow? Because we will not stop, because we will not rest. Well, let's see what it is that Jesus has to say to people like us, just as he spoke to people then and there. And we're pressing through the chapter divide that cuts this section here to hold these words from Jesus on rest in chapter 11 with 2 incidents that Matthew reports next, both concerning the Sabbath day, the day of rest. Sabbath, God's 7-day pattern for life, practiced by God, 6 days of creating and then resting, then mandated for Israel to stop working on the 7th day, to stop on the 7th year, and after 7 times 7 years, to stop for a year. Here we've got these 2 case studies. And then they're supported, as we heard, by words from the Jewish prophet Isaiah, 500 years before Jesus, and yet written entirely about him. 2 observations for us to make about Sabbath from this. And the first is this, that Sabbath is for relief. Have a look down at the start of chapter 12, and you can see this first incident where Matthew tells of Jesus and his friends eating from a field on the day of Sabbath. They get accused here in verse 2 of acting unlawfully. They've worked. They've been harvesting on the day of rest. Do you notice the way the Pharisees are? See their Pharisaic posture? They stalk Jesus, it seems. They're tracking his every move and that of his followers. They're lurking. They want to find faults. They're prowling to observe, to expose him and to somehow elevate themselves. And we might scorn them. But I wonder if some of us find their posture all too familiar in our own lives. Woe to them who think themselves holier than Jesus, as they did. Woe to those who jump on the needy, which is what we find them doing here. We know that in just the previous paragraph, Matthew tells us Jesus has invited his people to rest. And he's not saying no to Sabbath. He offers his people his light yoke, not no yoke. And now we find his accusers have missed the point. We can probably say that Jesus' disciples were gleaning in the fields. They were like Ruth. God provided for his people. You could pick from the edges of the fields so that you wouldn't go hungry. And yet Jesus here doesn't turn to the book of Ruth to defend their actions. He could have done that. Instead, he turns to an incident in the life of David and his men where they ate bread that was set apart in the tabernacle. Notice what he says to these legal experts who are accusing him. Haven't you read? Have they? And I wonder if we have to ask ourselves, have we? Do we know what this is about? In that situation, David and his companions entered and they ate the priest's bread. And we're told this was not lawful for them to do, technically speaking. And yet Jesus says, haven't you read? He continues on that the priests had freedom to eat such bread, and in doing so, they could desecrate the Sabbath. They could violate it. And yet, we're told they were innocent in verse 5 when they did that. Why? Because they served the Lord and his anointed one. They were filling up what was intended on the Sabbath rather than breaking it. And Jesus says, now here in verse 6, something greater has come. We're in a greater time than in David's day. Here is God's chosen, beloved, delighted in, anointed king, as Isaiah says at the end of the reading we had. And Jesus says this, verse 7, if you had known what these words mean, turning for a second time, as he did in chapter 9, to the book of Hosea, that the Lord desires mercy, not sacrifice, well, then you would look at Jesus' disciples and you would see that just as David's men were innocent, so too are these. Why? Because Sabbath is not for leaving hungry those who serve the Lord. Neither was it the case that the priests would get to eat their fill but leave other people hungry. Especially on the Sabbath, it mattered that the hungry be filled. Especially on this day, God provides relief to those who are in need. And so he fills those who are described in verse 1 as hungry, hungry disciples of Jesus. And those who were companions of David too, who were hungry in verse 3. The Sabbath is a Christ-like thing to meet the needs of those who are lacking. Sabbath's not about putting my feet up and having the break that I'm entitled to. No, it's something you need because you're needy, because you're weak, because you're hungry. And so to have Sabbath is to preach to myself the words of Jesus who says, come to me. To rest is to tell myself of the rest that is found by faith in Christ. To rest in this way is to say, I am not the sum of my labors. I'm not the stuff I've acquired or the things that I've achieved, nor am I the things that I haven't gotten, haven't achieved. No, it's to humble myself. We humble ourselves by going to bed each night, or we should, admitting our need of sleep. So too, Jesus would have us humble ourselves by turning to him for salvation, to say, I cannot carry on my own. And we might resist both of those things. So no, I am determined to stand on my own two feet and be strong. And yet that sets us up against God. And evidence would suggest is self-destructive as well. So what is it in our lives that could teach us and could display our need of relief? That we're hungry people who need provision. I think it can get as practical, can't it, as using a diary. willfully setting aside time to spend with the Lord in prayer, in the scriptures, with other believers in this gathering or in smaller settings like in a home group, because we recognise that without God's words, we die. But his word sustains us. And if there is no confession of our need of that in our lives, then we die. And we know that life will always devour every moment in our diary, that we will never do all that we could do. So how much better to step back humbly, to let good things not happen, and to honour Jesus with the admission that I cannot do everything. It might be that we're missing opportunities to do good that we might, because we won't ever step back from the things we're already doing. Might some things in life need to stop so that others can start? And might other things just need to stop? Maybe the phone needs to go in a drawer one day a week. Maybe I need to buy a watch so that I can check the time without checking my work emails. Maybe I need an alarm clock so that there can be no phone in the bedroom. For those who are students, maybe you can work outside your bedroom in the library. So you can stop each day and for one day a week to say, I will not work in the evenings and I will not work on a Sunday because I am one who cannot keep going 24/7. I simply cannot do it. We might even find that doing less is more. Maybe we need to work less hours, to limit ourselves, to admit that we are hungry and needy beings, and we're dependent on Jesus to fill us, rather than being dependent on the work of our hands. Can we be boldly needy, going to Jesus in faith, as the one who's a fountain who we honour by drinking from, relieving our need by going to him, praising him by drinking from him, and that when we do that, maybe we might then be able to pour ourselves out to nourish other people as well. Maybe, just maybe, people who follow Jesus could be unusually distinctive in a crazy busy world. Because we say, I cannot do this. I'm not infinite in my capacity. I need help. Firstly, Sabbath is for relief. And then secondly, Sabbath is for restoration. Have a look at the second incident that's recorded here. At verse 9, going on from that place, he went into the synagogue. This time we're not in the fields, we're in the synagogue. And now, again, here are the Pharisees. They're looking for a reason to bring charges against Jesus. Talk about being on the wrong side of history. First, they accuse his disciples in verse 2 of unlawful practice on the Sabbath. And now they're trying to set Jesus up. They ask him a question. Verse 10 says, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? It's a good question, isn't it? I wondered, what would you say? Do you know? What do you think? And Jesus sets up a little case study for them. Look what he says in verse 11. If any of you has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will you not take hold of it and lift it out? I'm not sure any of us own a sheep that I'm aware of, but you can think of kind of equivalent situations perhaps. What should you do? If you have a sheep and it falls in a pit, should you lift it out on a day of rest or not? I'm not going to take a vote on this one. What do you think? Jesus says, well, of course you would. And he explains in the very next verse, how much more valuable is a person than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Of course you would take the sheep and lift it up. It's a sheep who's stuck in a pit, that's not at rest. It's not going to be happy. Likewise, a human being, more valuable than a sheep, and in need of good being done, of healing coming to them. Of course it's right to do good on a day of rest. Would you want to rule against that? Seems they would. And before they can answer, he says in verse 13 to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and it was completely restored, just as sound as the other. Before they can answer, he speaks to the man who needs healing. Stretch out your hand, and the man gets completely restored. His hand is now sound and healthy. Jesus has done good on the Sabbath, shouldn't he? Isn't that what the day is for? To relieve need when you're hungry and to restore what is broken in this situation? And notice what happens with the prowling religious leaders in verse 14. Exit stage left. They went out and plotted how they might kill Jesus. No one thinks they're the bad guy. No one wants to be the villain, but how badly wrong are they? Their approach to the Sabbath is to practice it so that you could barely lift a finger without making your conscience tremble, to wonder, have I done the right thing? Notice what they're doing. They set themselves up against the Lord's anointed, and they go and they scheme in dark corners to kill him. And what does he do? Verse 15, aware of this, Jesus withdrew from that place. A large crowd followed him, and he healed all who were ill. He goes out to do good for more and more people. And Matthew tells us why. That this, verse 17, was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. Jesus is filling up what Isaiah said would happen. That the servant of the Lord, the chosen, beloved, delighted in one, on the whom the Spirit rests. I mean, these verses are amazing, aren't they? Here is my servant whom I've chosen, the one I love, in whom I delight. I will put my Spirit on him and he will proclaim justice to the nations. You could meditate on that all week. Why don't you do that? That would be a good thing to do, wouldn't it? To fix our attention upon this Jesus, the rest bringer, the Sabbath giver who comes to people who are described in verse 20 as like bruised reeds or smouldering wicks, the fragile, the flickering. And he will persist in coming to such people until he has brought justice through to victory, and that in his name the nations will put their hope. Restlessness, never stopping, a formless life. Those are matters for Jesus of injustice in this world. And he fights for the good of those who will answer his invitation. Come to me. It's a call to rest in him, to be relieved and to be restored. And then just maybe to begin to offer rest to others. We don't have to live for the weekend, the holidays or retirement. Though we can receive each of those as a gift, just as work itself is a gift. But we cannot live endlessly without any rhythm or rest. And so here we see Jesus says, first, come and trust me. Come have your need met, come be restored. And then you might offer rest to other people. What does that look like in practice? I'm helped by the perspective of two guys I know, and they advocate this through the lens of a Sabbath-like hospitality. They say this, open door, open fridge is our rule in life. One of them, though, travels a lot with work and often then finds himself coming home to a busy house. He says, look, I get in the house, it's late, I just want to go upstairs, flick on my computer and catch up on Match of the Day. He says, I don't think that's wrong. Yeah, might not rest as one resting in Jesus, he says, look like moving towards my house guests in love and service when it's the last thing I want to do. Can look like either, can't it? Similarly, his friend says, yes, we believe in an open door and an open fridge, but there are times that if you knock on our door, we will tell you it's not a good time and you should come back later. I wonder, do we know ourselves? Which way do we tend to lean? I think we need wisdom to resolve that, to move against our sinful instincts, whichever way they tend to go, and to say, my rest is in Jesus. I think we need each other's help on that. It's questions we could ask each other as we spend time together after the service. Though in all of that, it seems to me if we erred on the side of how can I refresh other people, then as a community hearing these words, we wouldn't go far wrong. None of us can work endlessly. And work is, of course, far more than paid employment. There's many a parent of young children who knows what it is to go back to work for a rest after the school holidays. And yet we chuckle at that, of course, rightly. But we also know, those of us in that situation, that the company of the most high-octane infants can be deeply restorative as well. And somehow that's also true. Here, again, words from Rosaria Butterfield on her Sabbath practice of hospitality. I've read these words before this term, but I think they bear repeating. Hospitality is necessary, whether you have cat hair on the couch or not. People will die of chronic loneliness sooner than they will of cat hair in the soup. Know that someone is spared another spiral binge of pornography because he is instead playing Connect Four with you, or walking the dogs, or jumping on the trampoline. Things you take for granted have been the Lord's appointed escape for a brother or sister. Know that someone is spared the fear and darkness that comes with their depression because they are needed at your house, always on the Lord's day. The day she's never alone, but is instead safely in community, where her place at the table is needed and necessary and relied upon. Meditating on those words is messing with my life in all kinds of good ways that I'm thankful for. I wonder what would Sabbath practice like that look like for us? To challenge the idea that an Englishman's home is his castle. To say, no, a Christian's bricks and mortar and everything else we have is to be wielded for the restoration of others. But for the Christian, the nuclear family is not the ultimate family. It matters, and investing in it is increasingly distinctive in a culture where the place of family has fallen rapidly as homes get broken and generations get scattered. How much of our social care crisis is fueled by our social mobility? And I ask myself that question as one who doesn't live all that near his own parents. How do we do that? Do those who are single in the church family need to forcibly insert themselves into families in church? The families need to deliberately invite people into their lives. Maybe it works both ways, so that both can benefit from the relative strengths and contributions of the other. Because in the church, the true family is us. We are family to each other. Our relationships, not so much bonded by DNA, but by the thicker blood of Jesus. So will we, who call ourselves Christian, go beyond what seems reasonable to express relief and restoration to one another? Can church be where people get made new? Now, perhaps with all of this, you say, just don't ask me to do anything more. I'm not. I'm saying we need to recognize our need of help, that we cannot do everything, that we cannot save ourselves, that we may need to slow down, to live smaller lives, to have less people that we know more deeply, do less things, but more richly, to embrace the kind of Sabbath that Jesus describes with rest and slowness and patience and awareness of our limitations. There have been times where, as a family, where we've had to embrace slower seasons and frustrating limits as chronic illness has come close. And I know that many here have had those kind of experiences too. And there have been times where I have raged at that. And I think the Lord would invite that kind of praying. But there's times too where I have known the freedom of going slow. Doing less. Of hearing the words of Jesus here in this ink that's in front of us now, that break through the overwhelming noise and of a busy life, to speak to the weary and the burdened, the hungry and the shriveled, the fragile and the flickering, where Jesus says, come to me. Come to me and I will give you rest. And so for us this morning, let us give him our burdens. Give him your exhaustion. Give him the busyness. Give him the over-connectedness. and then receive from him his life-giving light yoke, his relief, his restoration. And then as we rest in him, we might begin to open our tired eyes and look and see how we might bring relief and restoration to other people. Maybe even beginning with those to the left and right of us now. Let's take a moment to pray. And then we're going to sing together before we come to the Lord's table. Father, take your word and apply it to our hearts and to our lives. Turn our hearts again to your Son, to Jesus. Amen. Let's stand and sing together. And if those who are serving communion this morning can come forward as we do that.